This is the most beautiful place on earth.
A passage from Edward Abbey's book, Desert Solitaire.
There are many such places. Every man, every woman, carries in heart and mind the image of the ideal place. The right place, the one true home, known or unknown, actual or visionary. A houseboat in Kashmir. A view down Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. A gray Gothic farmhouse 2 stories high at the end of a Red Dog Road in the Allegheny Mountains. A cabin on the shore of a blue lake in spruce and fir country. A greasy alley near the Hoboken waterfront. There's no limit to the human capacity for the homing sentiment. Theologians, sky pilots, astronauts have even felt the appeal of home calling to them from up above, in the cold black outback of interstellar space. For myself, I'll take Moab, Utah. I don't mean the town itself, of course, but the country which surrounds it, the canyon lands, the slick rock desert, the red dust and the burnt cliffs and the lonely sky, all that which lies beyond the end of the roads.
That's the beginning of Edward Abbey's book, Desert Solitaire, read by Carl Schmidt. The book changed the way people thought about the desert and made Abbey the patron saint of young environmental activists. Abbey died in 1989, but his legacy lives on. Steve Paulson has more.
For years, Edward Abbey struggled to be a writer. He took a series of jobs he didn't much like, factory worker, welfare officer, teacher, while he tried to make it as a novelist. But it was another job that led to his big breakthrough. In the late 50s, Abbey worked as a backcountry ranger at Arches National Monument in Utah. He later wrote about that job in Desert Solitaire, which became the classic book on the American desert.
When I read Desert Solitaire in about 1970, it's the best book I'd ever read. And I credit Ed Abbey for changing our notions of what a pretty landscape is.
Dave Foreman was the founder of the environmental group Earth First.
You know, our landscape aesthetics come from the Alps. For a long time, only the big peaks, sparkling jewel-like lakes, were attractive wild places. And I think Ed's writing, particularly Desert Solitaire, made it okay to say that you liked scrubby, arid landscapes.
Before Desert Solitaire was published in 1968, the desert was commonly seen as a wasteland, a place fit for little more than cactus and rattlesnakes. It was a dumping ground for all the crap you wanted to get rid of, or where you tested nuclear bombs. Abbey grew up in Pennsylvania, but after college he fell in love with the desert while hitchhiking through the Southwest. His friend Jack Leffler says Abbey found the lush landscapes back east too hemmed in, too confining, unlike the great vistas of the desert.
Out here, where it's not uncommon to be able to see 100 miles, the mind has every chance at the latitude necessary to really be free. That, coupled with the fact that you can go camping without tripping over somebody else's sleeping bag every 10 feet, it gets to you. When you're a desert rat, you know it. Once you've had your first scorpion sting or been bitten by a centipede, you've been inoculated for life.
Jack Leffler's written a biography of Abbey called Adventures with Ed. He's read all 21 of Abbey's books, but there's one passage in Abbey's writing that always sticks with him. It's from the first chapter of Desert Solitaire.
I want to be able to look at and into a juniper tree, a piece of quartz, a vulture, a spider, and see it as it is in itself, devoid of all humanly ascribed qualities. To meet God or Medusa face to face, even if it means risking everything human in myself. I dream of a hard and brutal mysticism in which the naked self merges with a non-human world and yet somehow survives still intact, individual, separate, paradox, and bedrock.
Desert Solitaire is more than just beautiful nature writing. There's an ornery quality to the book, including plenty of potshots at Abbey's old employer, the National Park Service. He detested all the roads that made things easy for tourists and their cars. There's also an insatiable appetite to experience life at its rawest, like the time Abbey killed a rabbit with a rock just to see if he could, in case a day came along when he needed to get food with his own hands. Still, it was the writing in Desert Solitaire that shaped an entire generation of environmental activists. Again, Jack Loeffler.
It was, to the West, at least as compelling as Thoreau's Walden was for the East. It really was that powerful. To this day, it is regarded as probably the great classic book of essays to have emerged from the American Southwest.
Part of the appeal of Desert Solitaire was its in-your-face politics. Abbey had been radicalized in the early 60s by the construction of the Glen Canyon Dam, which stopped up the once mighty Colorado River. He had fantasies about blowing up the Glen Canyon Dam, didn't he?
Well, one of the fantasies in which I was honored to be included, should I so desire, he had this notion of creating an adobe houseboat, filling it with explosives, and floating near the base of the Glen Canyon Dam, then sinking the boat and blowing a hole in the dam, and then being upstream in a huge rubber raft where the two of us would run the Colorado River in full tilt. And with any luck at all, it would take out the Hoover Dam as well, and we'd end up in the Sea of Cortez. And listening to the symphonies of Beethoven as we went. This was one of Ed's big fantasies.
Ed Abbey was an anarchist at heart. In fact, he wrote his master's thesis on the morality of political violence. One of his heroes was the Russian anarchist Bakunin. Jack Loeffler considers Abbey one of the great anarchist thinkers of the 20th century.
He melded anarchist thought and environmentalism in such a way that the radical environmental movement actually had him as a spiritual guide.
I'd go so far as to say that a bulldozer tearing up a hillside, ripping out trees for the purpose of a logging operation or a strip mine is committing a kind of terrorism against life.
That's a recording of Ed Abbey made by Jack Loeffler on one of their camping trips in 1982. Abbey saw a clear distinction between sabotage and terrorism. He considered sabotage an act of violence against property, while terrorism was violence against people and other living things.
Personally, I feel that when all other means fail, as a last resort, we are morally justified, and not merely justified, but morally obligated to defend that which we love by whatever means are available. Just as if my family, my wife, or my children were attacked, I wouldn't hesitate to use violence to defend them. By the same principle, if land I love is being violated, raped, plundered, murdered, and all political means to save it have failed, I personally feel that sabotage is morally justifiable.
Abbey was himself a saboteur. In what he called his night work, he'd dump caro syrup and sugar into the diesel tanks of heavy machinery and throw spiked objects onto roads to pop the tires of lumber trucks. His philosophy of resistance, which he spelled out in his novel, The Monkey Wrench Gang, made him a hero to young activists like Dave Foreman of the radical environmental group Earth First. But what made Abbey so memorable wasn't his blueprint for sabotage. Foreman says it was the way he opened people's minds to question basic assumptions.
Ed was the classic coyote, the trickster, upsetting everybody, being outrageous in polite company, and making people think.
Give me an example of that.
Portraying himself as a redneck, his character, Hayduke, throwing beer cans on the highway, saying, "Problem's not the beer can, it's the highway." These things that seem even obscene at first, but when you stop to think about them, there's a message there.
Over the years, Jack Loeffler went on lots of camping trips with Ed Abbey. They'd drive their pickup trucks out into the desert along with a stash of pork chops, potatoes, and beer, and ruminate on the meaning of existence. One day, Abbey got to talking about death and made Loeffler promise that if one of them ever got really sick, the other would make sure he didn't die in a hospital. Years later, Loeffler made good on that solemn vow.
Ed was indeed in a hospital, and there came a moment in time when he knew that he was going to die, and he said, "It's time." And so I started pulling tubes out of him, and we loaded Ed onto a gurney, and away we went. The sun came up out in that Sonoran desert. It was March. And by golly, I heard after 2 hours of Ed laying there preparing to die, "Loeffler, it's too damn hot to die out here. Get me out of here." And so we loaded him back up and stuck him in the truck and took him back to his cabin. And he lasted a few more days, and then he died about 8:30 one morning. And I quickly loaded him into a sleeping bag, which is what he wanted. And we stashed him in the back of my pickup truck. And in two vehicles, four of us, went deep into an unnamed desert. And the following morning, we had gotten his grave dug. I remember laying in the bottom of Ed's grave and looking up at the sky and seeing both a turkey vulture and a red-tailed hawk fly by. Hopped out of the grave, and we lowered Ed into it and buried him. We poured a bottle of tequila and some beer on it and had some ourselves and said adios to a great man.
To this day, Loeffler won't say where Abby's buried, but somewhere out in the desert, there's a rock with Abby's name on it and his dates. Born January 29th, 1927, died March 14th, 1989, and the epitaph that Abby requested, "No comment."
Steve Paulson prepared that profile of Edward Abbey.